All lines are now bridged.
Great, thank you. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the USCDI Task Force meeting. Today, we'll have continued discussion on the task force recommendations. So let me officially open the meeting with a roll call, starting with your co-chairs. Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Leslie Kelly Hall.
Good morning.
Good morning. Jim Jarrett. Ken Kawamoto.
Morning.
Les Leonard. Tim McDonald. Aaron Mary.
Good morning.
Good morning. Brett Oliver.
Good morning.
Thank you. Michelle Schreiber.
Good morning.
Good morning. Sasha Termont.
Good morning.
Good morning. Andy Trescott. Carol Turner.
He's lounging in the lobby.
Okay.
Good morning.
All right. So I'll mark him down. Denise Webb.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hans Budendijk. Not yet. Ricky Bloomfield.
Good morning. I'm here.
Good morning. Mark Savage.
Good morning.
Good morning. Ben Vereen.
Who was that? Sorry, what was that last one you called?
Oh, Ben Vreeman. My apologies.
Dan Vreeman.
I'm here, yes.
Okay.
No worries.
Great Cordova.
Here.
Okay, and John Kilbourn.
Good morning.
Good morning. Stephen.
Actually, Leslie's going to kick us off today.
Okay, great.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to more hard work and great meeting. We have some wonderful things to work on and also some news to report from our presentation to HITAC. It seems like a bit ago, but it was just last week, right? So we also have today joining us a new member, Dr. John Kilbourn, who is our now representative for CMS. And Dr. Kilbourn, I wonder if you'd take a minute and introduce yourself.
Hi, yes, I'm from the VA. And
oh, I'm sorry.
And,
I knew that.
I worked in terminology basically for the last, 20 or so years. And I came to the VA about 4 years ago from the National Library of Medicine, where I was the head of MESH, which involved the UMLS and META and RX Norm and the SNOMED extension. Those were all part of what I had to do at National Library of Medicine. And now I'm at the Veterans Administration, where I'm part of the terminology team at the VA. So the part of medical informatics that I'm most familiar with would be terminology, and I'm very interested in participating here and hopefully being of help.
Thank you. We will count on you to be of great help. Your background is tremendous, and as we tackle with many of the questions around terminology, I'm sure you'll provide wonderful assistance. Stephen, do you want to go ahead and talk about the past meeting, or how would you like to proceed?
You want to give some reflections on our HITAC
sure.
discussion for those who weren't there?
Yes, I thought it went very well. There was no pushback on our schedule and the work done to date. There were some questions about particular work on provider name and asking us to make sure that any recommendations we have that we've thought through all consequences of such. They were generally receptive with good questions. We did put forward a heads up that we would like their guidance in future meetings around stakeholders that they felt should be prioritized. Because as we go through these efforts, we are constantly faced with how do we prioritize perhaps the tension or sometimes competing efforts of different stakeholders, from regulatory bodies to the data underserved like patients and public health, to the providers themselves and also payers and other stakeholders. So we have given that heads up, and we hope to have some guidance as we go forward in our future efforts. That was my take on it. How about you, Stephen?
Yeah, the only other thing I'll add is that Steve Posnack specifically did chime in regarding our recommendations to change the name of the I'm trying to remember which way we're going, but the care team member name, that was what we're advocating for. And his comment was really primarily to think about data collection ramifications and what downstream impacts might be. Because, of course, the vendors would need to implement this change, and then as that data moves around the system, everyone would need to be aware of that change that would be considered. So he wasn't against the change, but really encouraged us to really think that through all the way along down the line. There was also some public comment that came in about considering the challenges of using an NPI for individuals and to be able to include those individuals who might not have an NPI. Again, something that I think we've talked about, but also it was really nice to see that coming in through the public comment. The other thing that I jotted down was there was really a discussion about what it means to be the core data for interoperability. And what those terms mean in the title. And I think a lot of work around the concept of core at being the most important and valuable data that we exchange across the ecosystem to support patients, caregivers, et cetera. So I think we'll be coming back to that in our discussion, especially around task 1C. So with that, why don't we go ahead and dive in. If we go down a couple of slides, we in the deck, we do have the URL for our task force website. Again, there were some delays in getting that up and going, but it's there now. And I think essentially all of you should be listed and have your little bio there. And if you see any problems on that site, be sure to let the ONC team know about that. And that'll be there for reference. So I think with that, we want to jump in. Again, we were in the midst of working through task 1B. We got pretty much through all of it last time before the presentation to HITACH, but there were a couple of things left. So Al, could we ask you to bring up first the shared spreadsheet, the recommendations tracking spreadsheet. Hans did introduce one new comment on there, and is Hans here? Do we have Hans?
Yes, I'm on.
Oh, there you are. Yeah, I see you. Good. Okay. So I wanted to touch on that if we can, and then we'll jump into the member recommendations doc where we, Al and I, had some subsequent discussion after our meeting about units of measure that I just wanted to share with folks. And then Hans will turn to you again to talk about encounter diagnosis. So while Al's bringing that up, on the task force recommendations document, I hope you all have that handy on row 13. There we go. This was the discussion of laboratory tests and the bounds of laboratory tests, and we talked about that. And the idea, we last time came to the conclusion that we wanted to recommend including diagnostic studies and exams with results data in V2. And Hans, you had a little bit of a supplement that I think you added since that discussion. I think I've got the timing right, where you say, while in principle adopting diagnostic studies is appropriate, the challenge is to understand the scope in terms of vocabulary. Can we define a clear set of LOINC codes or other encoding as the documentation diagnostic studies and how they are to be represented consistently through support standards? So I don't know, Hans, if you wanted to elaborate on that, if that's just sort of a footnote, if you will, to the recommendation.
Sure. So the challenge, I think, with diagnostic studies is that there's a wide variety of them, and they may be documented in a variety of different ways across different systems or even within systems, depending on the context and where it's being used. So unlike laboratory pathology, diagnostic imaging, where there's more definition and clarity around that, diagnostic studies that may be more widespread. So having an understanding, perhaps by starting with a targeted list and say, hey, these are the studies that we look and focusing on vocabulary aspects of it, might be an appropriate first step to move that because there is such a variety of expressions and capabilities out there that it would be very challenging to understand, okay, how are we going to get our arms fully around it? Not to say it's not being documented, but the variety in ways in which it's being documented, we would need to look at. So start to recognize the need for it, and begin with clearly defined a set of studies of interest, and begin to build from there.
I guess one question in my mind, would diagnostic studies be considered, you know, beyond the laboratory, would they be considered a new data class altogether? And then we could specifically define elements within the class as we included, you know, as we said, cardiac, pulmonary, you know, EEG, sleep. I mean, there are so many different categories. Might it be appropriate to think about what are the highest priorities, sort of thinking cardiac, you know, and EKG results in particular, you know, being so relevant to a very common cause of morbidity and mortality, which is cardiovascular disease. You know, might that be an appropriate place to start if we wanted to consider doing this in smaller chunks?
Yes, I would agree with that. That taking that in chunks, not considered necessarily part of lab, but beyond that, and the variety of it that then you named a couple of them in which they are being expressed are not all the same, or they're not done in the same parts of the system, et cetera. So therefore, we need to look at that to see how we can progress that and recognize that where do we have standards for that clearly. How widely are they adopted and where do we not? What can fit into more general categories where that's done, where not? So I think there's a little bit more work to be done to make sure that we then have more expression of those.
Clem, your hands up.
So I understand what Hans is saying, but there are lots of codes available for EKG, spirometry, and a lot of the overview tests. And LOINC, and whether we couldn't take the position that use the LOINC code when it's available, and like we have in other spaces, even in the lab, you know, there's still possibly a new test that won't have a LOINC code, that use whatever you have. So I think that would get us started. And EKG is very rich, echo is very rich, spirometry is pretty rich. Most of the really common studies have rich numbers of LOINC codes. I just hate to be putting this off when these are tests that have been sent by computers in V2 for decades.
All right. So so does the group have a feeling about whether we would specifically want to suggest this as a new data class in V2 versus elements under laboratory tests? I mean, to me, that seems more honest, if you will, as opposed to kind of trying to sneak it in under laboratory.
Yeah, I agree with you, Stephen.
They're not laboratory tests, as much as I'd like to see them flowing.
All right. Anybody feel? Sorry.
Just pointing to the. This is Al from ONC, just pointing to the existing submission, which is a level 2 data class and data element on diagnostic studies, which is mentioned in column K, which is the final recommendation determination. So there is an existing data element and data class for diagnostic studies. I just wanted to point that out. Although the one data
and it's in level two, right?
That was submitted by CMS in particular in support of ECQMs, but there's obviously many other use cases for it. And the recommendation in that submission was to use Low-Ink as the default. And obviously, as Clem pointed out, other code systems could be used to represent different groups or different categories of diagnostic studies.
Andy's hand is up. Andy?
Yeah, thanks, Leslie. Stephen, I just want to clarify so I understand exactly what you're asking us. Were you asking us to recommend that this should be underneath lab tests in general, or were you saying where do you want it, underneath lab tests or as a separate discipline? Maybe diagnostic studies is actually the superset as opposed to a subset of labs, and labs should be a subset of diagnostic. I'm not quite sure what the question was, and I'd like to hear from people who have much more expertise in this precise space about how they should be treated.
Yeah, I think the current proposal that's on the table is to look at the new level two data class, diagnostic studies and results, I think is what it's called. I'm just peeking back and forth. Diagnostic studies / exams, that's what it's called. That was submitted by CMS, and perhaps Michelle could comment on that. And that we are going to suggest that we elevate that level two data element to version two and consider starting with a subset of most commonly and most used and impactful studies such as those in the cardiovascular space. I think that's the proposal. Okay. I mean, I'll make that as a motion, if you will, even though I'm co-chair and you're not supposed to. But let's bang that around and see if people are comfortable with that.
Before we have a vote, we have a comment from Dr. Kilbourn, also has a comment she'd like to make.
I'm actually in agreement with what was just said, because I think limiting the scope of this, say, initially to cardiovascular studies versus anything at all that might have a result is a wise move. In other words, to limit the scope of this, because I think if we just say anything that a physician or a clinician can find or see or know about a patient is just possibly opening up the door too wide and leading to, you know, decades of discussion that never end. But limiting it to cardiovascular studies initially and just seeing how that goes might be a wise approach.
I would disagree. Cardiovascular studies are an important one. It shows spirometries, and chest is available and just as standardized. There's a number of other ones. Optical tonometry, you know, it protects you from blindness. It's a simple number, easy as pie. You know, I think better to go that if the codes aren't available, people have to use something else and request them too. But rather than just keep, this has gone on for decades. We got labs that don't have the other stuff that's almost as important.
Well, if we can limit the scope in some way, because there's discussions around in the SLOMED world about observables and anything that can possibly be known about a patient, and what do we call that, a finding, an observable, and I don't see that's going to land anywhere. And that's what I'm concerned about, is not landing.
Well, let's see, what does Medicare want? I think they want a little broader spectrum because they want it for quality assurance, and there's other important tests.
Michelle, as the submitter, representing the submitter of the diagnostic studies exams, you want to comment?
Yeah, thanks. You're right. And stand up too, so thank you. I mean, in our letter, we were actually kind of broad with you that the additional data classes and we strongly suggested were observations with results, including diagnostic studies and exams, and we weren't that specific as to which ones. Diagnostic exams like bone density or eye exams or screenings. I think making it a subcategory or you know, another subtopic. This is, that's probably, Stephen, we would agree, the direction that we'll need to go, because there are going to be a lot of these. As people here are already pointing out, it's not just cardiovascular. There are a lot of these. And I think over time we will need to rethink them. So CMS actually wasn't specific about which diagnostic studies at this time.
Great. Well, I think, again, our recommendations, which were, you know, we'll come back to the fact that we only have a few weeks to put them together, will be fairly high level. We don't need to get down deep into the weeds, and we can leave it to Al and company to sort this out. Again, I think we're really quite fortunate that Al and the team, who will be reviewing all of the public and high-tech comments, you know, has been here listening, participating in our dialogue this whole time. So I don't think we need to spend a lot more time on that. I've tried to capture the core of our discussion and our recommendation, and I think I would suggest that we move on to the.
But we're
not really a voting body. Does anybody disagree with the direction that we're going in?
I think we have sufficient disagreement across this group so far that it's not resolved. That's just my view.
Andy, sorry, please articulate that. What I have here in column K is that we would recommend suggesting elevating the new level 2 data class of diagnostic studies and exams submitted by CMS to be included in version 2, and to consider starting with a subset. Do you disagree with in there?
I think that's fine, but we need to articulate the relationship between diagnostic studies and exams and laboratory tests and results. Just so
it's a separate data class.
But we need to be clear what goes into one and what goes into the other. And when you've got certain types of cardiovascular studies that also include laboratory tests.
Well, Andy, I'd suggest we just make a comment. The laboratory class is separate, and laboratory tests require specimens, and that other categories don't.
Yep. It's a that's fine.
Gotcha. All right. I've captured that in our in the comments. I know it's a little hard to read in Adobe, but hopefully you're all able to follow along in Google. We've got that. Is that good, Andy? Are you comfortable?
Yeah, that's awesome. Immaculate, Ms. Dr. Lane.
Love it. Love it. Let's keep going then. All right, let's flop over. I don't think there were any other new comments in the recommendations tracking document that I saw. If anybody's aware of a comment that they've entered there that we have not attended to, please, you know, raise your hand and bring it to our attention. Otherwise, we'll move on to the recommendations document on row 11, where we finished up last time discussing laboratory units of measure and the need for the clarification that a laboratory values and results must have units of measure included. And Al and I spoke after our meeting, and he made the point that units of measure is a standard that applies to a data element, not a data element itself. And that the exclusion of an applicable standard was intentional on the part of ONC due to concerns about the existence of an applicable standard that could be used across the entire domain of laboratory data. Leaving this out means that any applicable standard is acceptable. When there's a disagreement between the CCDA and FHIR US Core, ONC does not see that it is its role to break the tie. So, Al, I don't know if you want to add to that, but again, I think that addresses our question as to whether units of measure needed to be a data element unto itself.
I think you captured what we talked about, and just as a, I guess, as a reminder, UCOM is one of the two standards that listed under vital signs, where it's much more clear, at least in my head, it's much more clear that the right thing, the right standards for vitals, almost only low-ink and units, you know, the vital sign measurement and the units that is the result of the measurement. So I think I think that that's so there's a possibility of UTHM being is an appropriate standard for lab results, but not the only one. So that's
I don't know where you're getting ideas. Is it contradiction between CDA and FHIR on UCOM and the U.S. Corps? There isn't. And it's also supported by DICOM and by IEEE. I don't know what the alternative is. Tell me what the competition is for a computable standard.
We're not making the assumption or the assertion that UCOM's not an appropriate applicable standard. I'm saying that where it's not clearly the only one or the almost only one to be used in a certain setting, that it shouldn't be designated as a required standard. But it's not a data element; it's a data standard.
Well, we can separate. That's okay. But how are you going to ever automate the use of numeric values without a unit standard? We look at units, and I found there's 120 string representations for red blood cell counts. If you just look at the raw stuff that comes across from labs, how can you compute on that? And it's just I just don't understand where there's an alternative or who's proposing an alternative for laboratory units. They can still send their usual strings. It's not a contradiction.
There are several other representations of lab results, including a simple numeric and unit, which would be UCOM. But there's other things. There's LOINC results. There's SNOMED results. There's other things like.
Wait a minute. LOINC doesn't represent units. It carries them in its database, and they're UCOM units when it carries them.
Yeah.
Right. But sometimes LOINC is the answer. Sometimes SNOMED is the answer. Sometimes UCOM is the answer.
Well, UCOM, no, UCOM is not the answer. UCOM is a modifier of numerically valued tests. It's never the answer for a categorical test.
Yeah, Clem reflects my understanding, too.
Dan has a comment as well to add.
My comment Dan? Is that, sorry, can you hear?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so my comment is that the result value is a separate data element from the unit of measure. I mean, that's the way CDA treats it. That's the way FHIR treats it. It comes right along with it, but it's separate. And it's coded, meaning there's a structure for it, a code, a naming system, and a display string. And I think the challenge is that, yes, sometimes result values are numeric. Sometimes they're coded themselves, meaning it's positive or negative or detected, not detected. And sometimes it's a big old blob of text. We know that. It's just that in the case where the result value is quantitative, there's another data element that has to come along, and that's the unit of measure, and it's a coded representation. And I think, I think from the perspective of what's been implemented in everywhere, I don't think there's really disagreement on the use of UCOM for that purpose.
Hans had some comments in the chat.
No, go ahead, Leslie.
I was going to say Hans had some comment in the chat about UCOM. Hans, could you elaborate?
I could, but it's going to go a little bit more detailed. But units of measurements have been around as separate data elements for, Clem was part of the ASTM, the definition of OBX. So since that time, for sure. And it's just a matter of, has it always been entered in a structured fashion that it has been done separately? And once UCOM came around, it became a more defined structure for unit of measure to be recognized consistently. So I think we have to be careful mixing UCOM with answers and values. It's in a qualifier of it, but not something on its own. And agreed with Andy. There are other answers as well, but LOINC and SNOMED are the ones that where you can structure it, where you can encode it, that's where low-end and SNOMED are being used. Where you cannot encode it, it's text or it's numeric or something else.
So I would propose, with in the absence of hands momentarily, that we are not going to resolve this here. that we've had a rich conversation, that we will include and incorporate in our recommendations to ONC, and that I think to spend more time on this is probably to limit our time for other endeavors. Does anyone feel strongly about continuing here, or can we move on?
Well,
I mean, if you want to process numeric values automatically, it's impossible without a standard unit. So why don't we just forget about sending numeric values then, except for readable ones? I think it's a big deal. And maybe I'm the only one, and then you can just...
I second what you're saying, Tim.
Thanks, Les. Andy?
Yeah, it feels like there is a sufficient strength of opinion on the call, certainly from Clem. I don't think Clem is alone. I think there are others, myself included, who are lining up with the same point of view. It sounds like Hans is. I suspect there are others. It might be worth having a quick poll. But it feels like almost this group is actually saying something quite affirmative and strong about the sense of direction that we think is being taken. So if we say nothing, then there's kind of some degree of complicity inside that, which I don't think is reflective of the sentiment in this group.
Yeah, no, I agree, Andy, and I've tried to capture that in our discussion, but you're right. I have not gone on to capture this as a recommendation. So perhaps that's what we need to do. We actually didn't have recommendations in this particular spreadsheet. And yeah. Al, if you could just click the tab to go over to the second spreadsheet you have there in your browser. At the top, that would be terrific. Thanks. We're down on row 11. So I believe that the recommendation of the task force that I'm hearing is that UCOM would be an appropriate standard for units of measure. I mean, I heard Dan weigh in, Clem, and others, that when units of measure are included, that UCOM would be the standard. I haven't heard disagreement from anyone except perhaps Al. Is that fair? Does anybody object to that as what will be our recommendation?
I think that Hans has articulated it in the chat.
Piece
for it.
Yeah.
Okay. Where available across standards. All right. I'll try to capture that if I can. Okay. Okay. All right. Got it. All right. So we will be moving that over as a recommendation to the other side. All right. Thank you for that. Al, was that you?
Yeah, you just want me to flip back over now that you've captured that?
No. Now we want to move down to row 12, where we also left off, and invite Hans to go on. He did a lot of work on encounter diagnosis, and I think we wanted to finish that.
So this is trying to get a little bit more clarity. So it's not meant to argue against encounter diagnosis, but it can be a variety, and it needs to be clear, is that do we truly mean everything, every diagnosis that is associated with an encounter? Do we mean every clinical diagnosis or that was clinically relevant, which might be more than what might be relevant for billing or might be relevant for quality measures? So it would be helpful that there is clarity on that to ensure is that when we get downstream into the guidance and the standards that we can clarify which ones exactly are we looking for, because there are different types of diagnosis associated with an encounter. So that was the intent of the statement there. Last time we talked about it, but it still remained in general. So I want to get a little bit more specific as to which ones. And the second part is that in the proposal, the term reason is used and the term diagnosis is used, the term coding is used. Typically, terminology is used when you get into the standards part of it, is that the reason for the encounter allows for free text to indicate what is the reason that was articulated, why the patient is seeing the physician, clinician, otherwise. And therefore, having those two concepts next to each other is in itself helpful, but there is a distinction that is made where diagnosis is typically going for an encoded a statement, and reason is typically going for a free text statement, although it could have some codes, but it's typically that. So do we want to separate that out and make that more clear that there is an interest in the reason as defined that way, and there is the diagnosis, and then let's make sure that we understand which one ones we're looking for, just admit and discharge, all clinically relevant that have been associated with the encounter. Would that include working diagnosis, differential diagnosis? Is it just the ones that are going to be used for billing? How do we know that we have the proper set included?
Can I ask you a question? What would be considered the complete record in your mind then of the encounter diagnosis? Would that be the billable event? Because if we're looking for transparency, would you not indicate all associated diagnoses with that particular encounter?
I'm completely open. I just wanted to raise the question to make sure is that as USCDI then is being used to clarify US score and CCDA, that there's clear guidance there on what the intent of the scope is. So I'm neutral on that.
Les, you have a comment?
Les, Leonard. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, look, so I'm not sure we captured the reason for the encounter in a clinical note as much as we capture the chief complaint regularly. Of course, diagnostic codes are not diagnoses. They're, you know, what we're trying to diagnose in clinical encounters. And that oftentimes those are, you know, used in billing. And so, it's always important to remember the difference between, you know, trying to rule out a diagnosis, which may be your rationale for the billing, and a patient having the diagnosis. So I would recommend if you're going to have the reason for the visit, it probably needs to map to something like the chief complaint, because I don't think we capture reason for a visit in clinical care.
I think, Clem, I'll just comment, this is Stephen, that certainly in the ambulatory setting, that's often captured by the people who are making the appointments, who are scheduling. They'll ask that question. I think, as Hans said, it's typically entered as free text. Chief complaints, you know, in the system that I use, I think can be encoded, you know, that there's a list of chief complaints that you can use. I know there's yet another list for a reason for call. That is used. So, I mean, I think that there's often a mix. I agree, my feeling about this is when we speak of encounter diagnosis or encounter diagnoses, we're really talking about the diagnoses that are declared at the end of the encounter, you know, that are used for billing, for associating with orders, et cetera. And I think that kind of goes, certainly in the ambulatory clear. There's a clear list of encounters that are attached, diagnoses attached to every encounter. I think in the inpatient setting, it's a little more complicated because they don't tend to select diagnoses to associate with orders, but there are clearly a list of diagnoses at the end of an inpatient encounter that are established and utilized for billing purposes. So I think that when, you know, this was included, that it was really meant to include encoded diagnoses that were established, you know, through the course of the encounter. And I think that if we limited this or suggested limiting this to the billing diagnoses, that we would be capturing the data that's most important for stakeholders. Grace, did you want to comment?
I agree. So my concern is, realistically, in the real world, patients have very limited time with their doctor, and there may be a number of things happening, but in an 8 to 10 minute time frame, maybe one thing can be addressed, and it would require a series of appointments or visits to get down to the solutions for all the different reasons a patient may be showing up. I'm concerned with just a diagnosis for continuity of care purposes. Let's say a patient doesn't follow up. A system may lose that patient, and a doctor may lose that patient, not have an opportunity to follow up, perhaps with a social worker, a nurse navigator, or something like that. I want to think broader and more of the chronic illness, multiple comorbidities, populations, marginalized, vulnerable communities, which would benefit from capturing more than just a diagnosis, if that makes sense.
Well, are you speaking simply to the need for multiple diagnoses for an encounter, or are you...
You might not be able to diagnose everything at once, though, in the real world. So diagnosis is not going to, even if you have multiple diagnoses, that may not adequately capture. That's why the reason for visit, I think that seems to be a more comprehensive opportunity from my perspective.
Al, can you remind us, Al, reason for visit, is that somewhere down the line here under encounters? I'm looking real quickly.
There was one
the
of
chief
the
complaint.
It was a submitted data element reason. I think so. I don't have it pulled up, but let me do that right now.
I'm looking too. Yes. Okay. So there's a bunch of encounter items in comment, identifier, participant, time period, status, subject. Not sure what encounter subject means, just checking.
Could I just ask Grace something? I think I understand what she's saying. She's right on with this minuscule amount of time you got. But the question is, are you looking for a free text thing? For reason for the visit, so people can say whatever they want, or are you looking for a coding structure for either the diagnosis or reason for visit?
I mean, I'm happy with a coded structure. I'm just not seeing where you would capture that.
So you're looking for text, right? I just want to clarify that. Okay, thank you.
The other thing that I'll comment on, Grace, is that there are a lot of codes out there within ICD-10 that can be used to describe symptoms and complaints and concerns that are not true clinical diagnoses. And at least for my part, I code those. You know, somebody comes in with, you know, fatigue, malaise, you know, anxiety, whatever. You know, it's not a true diagnosis, but those can certainly be captured using the diagnosis field. But I agree that the reason for visit, I think everyone has said that that's typically free text. It doesn't look like we have that in there. So this is not really within our purview other than to say, you know, someone should submit that for version 3 because it doesn't look like that has been submitted yet.
Yeah, Stephen, this is Brett. I'm sorry, I'm just on the phone, so I can't raise my hand, but I would just...
Oh, okay, sorry.
That same piece. The reason for visit is oftentimes extremely vague. Checkup, follow-up, that's what gets typed in. So you're not missing a lot. I think the combination of the problem list and the diagnoses, whether they be symptoms or true diagnoses, are about as complete as you can get at this point, at least to your point in the ambulatory space.
I agree. I think Mark has a comment as well to add.
Yes, thanks. So I put it in the chat. We'll expand a little bit. ONC has had a reason for referral data element listed since 2018. I checked, and there are four data elements for referrals submitted. They're listed as comment right now. on the website. That may not be complete overlap with our current discussion of a broader reason for any visit, but I just wanted to flag that there may be some useful work already done. That particular data element was submitted by IHE.
Great. Yeah, and I do think those are. We've got a lot of hands up.
Yeah, I think our next one is Hans, and then Ricky, and then Lev.
Yes, I was just going to make a background comment. I was about to type it. In FHIR US Core, and I'm pretty sure in CCDI as well, a reason code or reason reference that can be textual, could be encoded along the lines of codes that Stephen mentioned, is already recognized. It's separated from diagnoses to make that distinction. So from a standards perspective, it's already there. But that then goes to the larger earlier comments that we have made, is that if we were to look at what's already must support or required, we would pick up a number of these things already.
Great. Ricky, did you have a comment?
Sure. Yeah, just building on what Hans just said there, I think that it would be a huge advance here just to have something in this field. And I think I've heard a lot of great comments about what specifically might be there. And I think that's also great. But from the viewpoint of the standardization, simply having something there will be really, really important. And then over time, that can be further refined based on additional feedback that might come. I think it's important to remember that, at least from the US Core perspective, that hasn't been implemented at scale yet, given that the requirement isn't until December of 2022. And I think we'll start seeing a lot, we'll gain a lot of knowledge as we see how this is implemented, and it can be refined over time based on feedback from the ecosystem. But simply having something there, I think, will be really important.
Thank you. Les, did you have a comment to add?
I probably have exactly the opposite position, that a blank field, which can represent one of four different data types of different data sources in free text, is potentially parsable with NLP or whatever, but we don't know what it means because we don't know who collected it, whether they're, you know, how they collected it, those types of things. I think that if we're going to have this, it has to be a field that's collected by, a medically trained person in business processes and is fairly structured as to what it means from, you know, the business process point of view. If it's just a placeholder for some free text comment by someone somehow, could be a patient, could be a provider, it could be a front desk clerk, it could be whatever, that has no value. It's just too vague and there's too much variability to be able to use it in any type of a decision support or analyses or other things.
So I think
I would clarify my comment to build on what Les said, that when I said something should be there, I actually would strongly encourage that it be something that's coded versus free text. And currently in US Core, for example, they recommend a value set that includes codes from one of the following four systems, which are all SNOMED codes, but it has the category of clinical finding, procedure, context-dependent category, or event. So quite a bit of leeway in terms of what can be there, but all of them are codes.
So what I'm hearing, to try to wrap this up and move on, is that we agree that encounter diagnoses should be coded, that they should be, you know, entered by, you know, professionals, that utilizing the billing diagnoses is probably a pretty close approximation to what we're looking for, though there might be some other opportunities to capture coded data, and that a free text reason for visit, which is similar to but different from reason for referral, would be valuable to consider for future versions. Is that fair?
I think you got it, Stephen.
Perfect. Okay. Great. I think we can say that we have, at this point, completed our work on 1B based on the submitted comments. And we're going to turn our attention to 1C, which will keep us busy for the rest of our time between now and our presentation to HITAC. I just wanted to share a couple of thoughts about our work in 1C, which I think will be very interesting. But clearly, a lot of people have suggested here, and I think we heard again at HITACH, that there may be an opportunity to expand the scope of version 2 beyond what was included in draft version 2. And I think as we go forward and we put together our recommendations and we consider all the various suggestions that people have, I think we're really looking for the Goldilocks experience here. You know, we don't want to ask for too much. We don't want to settle for too little. We really want to get just right. And I'm sure each of us has our own sense about where that Goldilocks balance lies. And I think that we as a task force are going to need to come to something resembling consensus. So I think as we think about these really good recommendations that people have put forward, that we should think about, you know, does this sort of in our hearts, does this make the cut? You know, is this so important that we should really encourage ONC to include it? Or are these really good things that perhaps could wait? I think, you know, and again, waiting means waiting a year. You know, it doesn't mean waiting forever. You know, version 3 is just around the corner, and hopefully many of us will be involved in the consideration of a draft version 3 12 months from now. So I want us to, you know, really be looking for that sweet spot as we think through these things. I think also, you know, there have been some clear, you know, vocal constituencies that have come forward. We're going to ask Grace to go through her, you know, carefully thought out recommendations that she's posted as public comment on the public website, as well as including here. I think Michelle, hopefully next week, will have a chance to do similarly from the CMS perspective. You know, if there are others who feel that, you know, that there's a voice that needs to be brought forward, I think we want to pursue that. You know, I think we've got a couple of weeks to work on this, but we don't have forever. And we really want to see, you know, what value we can add to ONC's consideration. So I just wanted to offer those as kind of orienting concepts. Does anyone have anything to add to that discussion before we invite Grace to walk us through some of her 1C recommendations?
This is Aaron. Can I add one color maybe to this that sort of echoes what we said at HITACH last week, and even Mickey mentioned it? I think a lot of these recommendations in 1C are really fabulous. And if we can build them in a context of trying to balance inequities of care across a care continuum, and like take food, right? We'll be able to if we share enough data and understand that, maybe we could uncover food deserts that we didn't know existed, things like that, or access to high quality food. Those kinds of, I think, those discussions would resonate a lot further given where we are now and what we have learned, particularly over the past year with COVID.
Thanks, Aaron. Other thoughts on the sort of the 1C discussion, if you will? We'll see what Politico makes of this. All right. Great.
Stephen?
Yes, Mark.
So I'll just build on what was just said to say there are a collection of comments on social determinants of health data class that may warrant a sort of a targeted discussion along the lines of the list you just mentioned.
Yeah, and I think, again, we have to remember that our current discussion, our 1C discussion, is bounded by the rules of engagement, which is to say that we are presently here to discuss items that have been leveled as level 2, that we may want to recommend consideration for inclusion in version 2. So as you've so clearly pointed out, a lot of the SDOH stuff is down at the comment level. So we will get to that after we finish this work. And I think, you know, we need to do the task at hand, which is looking at level 2 items that we may want to advocate moving into version 2.
Thanks. There is an SDOH data class that is at level 2.
Yes, indeed. And I'm guessing that Grace is going to take us there.
Okay, so I'm definitely going to use the analogy of Goldilocks because that's how I am looking at myself joining this group and all the work that's been done and trying to balance what the ecosystem needs versus what I see day to day with patients and their loved ones at the bedside and at home with their health situations. So let's dive in. There were two things both Leslie and I had discussed, allergies and intolerances. We both focused on the need for the data element food and non-meds to be recommended to be moved to USCDI V2. The reason for this was that the environmental and food allergies are material to care, and it is also likely now that we're seeing with COVID vaccination, allergies and reactions will need to be detailed as part of the public health and national response. So prioritizing from our perspective, some but not all allergens could endanger patient care. And I wanted to also comment, while we tried to bring our suggestions together, I did leave the second one separate. As you look at all of the different substances, do we also consider collapsing everything into allergens? Is that something that's possible? So I'd love to hear everyone's thoughts.
Not seeing any hands, I'll just chime in, Grace. I mean, I think in a lot of systems, they differentiate drug allergies from food allergies from environmental allergies. And I think that there are coding systems for each. So I think here, you know, this was listed as allergies and intolerances, food and non-meds as the data element. And you're again suggesting moving this to version two. What do people think? Is this one of those things that is going to make the Goldilocks cut here and warrant our support? Clem? Dr. McDonald, do you want to chime in? Clem, if you're talking, you're on mute.
He's typing that he lost connection.
Ah, got it. Okay. Well, we'll come back to Clem when he comes back in. Anybody else want to chime in on this?
I'll say this, David, particularly as we have done contact tracing and whatnot, and really have uncovered a lot, particularly about the Central Texas region, food and access of food and allergies and issues like that have really been underrepresented in a lot of the traditional data sets whenever people present themselves, particularly to our ambulatory side, unless they're coming in like specifically, like I think I have an allergy to shellfish or something. So I don't know so much about how we say intolerances and whatnot, but again, I go back to, I do think this type of data does have a lot of merit, and it ties to a lot of other comorbidities simply because of a lack of access to high quality food. Here, we've partnered with Meals and Wheels to try to address where we see that in the data, but obviously, if something like this is shared more readily, that can lead to a lot of other better outcomes.
Ricky?
I would just add that if it's not clear already that food and non-meds should be included in allergies and intolerances, we absolutely should do that. Just to point out that U.S. CORE in allergies already accounts for all of these, so the amount of implementation burden should be non-existent.
You know, I think it's important as we have these discussions to speak to both U.S. CORE and CDA, and I know we've got some people who have, you know, deep expertise in CCDA.
Steve, I'm back. If I
oh, good.
Okay.
Go ahead,
these
Clem.
Two spaces are really quite messy. Even the drug allergies are messy. You know, it turns out about 90% of the people who report a penicillin allergy are not allergic to penicillin, because there's a lot of confusion. With the food allergies, there's probably only 5 or 7 foods that count statistically. So that could be easily handled. But when we start to get, you know, Campbell's mushroom soup as an allergy, I mean, it can get really messy, and I think one has to be careful. And then in terms of the other kinds of allergies, the environment, it's probably just latex. I mean, there's not a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff that bothers people, but it's not necessarily an allergy. So I just think it's a messy space,
And we need to be careful. It would be nice to have a list of the common things that people could check off rather than have some monstrous thing with 10,000 chemicals and try to pick them. So it's just tricky, that's all.
Clem, this is Leslie. So, for instance, a walnut allergy can be indicative of a latex allergy. Someone might not have experienced a latex allergy yet, but by denoting that they have a walnut allergy, we can get there. And there are some other things like that. Is there a place where you suggest we can refer to find those statistics?
Well, there's one of the websites of either the American Allergy Association or Immunology, I don't know which one it is, lists the 7 or 8 important allergens that are not drug allergens. The real problem is there's so much, so aspirin, people, they get irritated by it, but it's not an allergy. I mean, there's just all these complexities of what's an allergy, which can be deadly, what's an irritation or some other kind of phenomenologic thing. So I think it would be really good to have a smallish list that people could pick from when they're really dealing with these non-drug allergies. But even the drug allergies are really kind of a mess because of confusions and misrepresentation of what's really a what.
The data class is entitled Allergies and Intolerances. So I think that acknowledges that these are not all allergic-mediated responses.
Well, it may, but that makes it even messier because they aren't the same clinical meaning.
Indeed. And I think the question before us is whether allergies and intolerances to foods and non-medication agents should be elevated from level 2 to version 2. That is really the only question
we are
contemplating.
I think medication things should be included, but I think we should be really make it practical for typical users to get the stuff in.
So medication allergies are already included in level 1, in version 1. So you've got the substance, drug class, substance medication, and reaction. So those are already in version 1. And then in draft version 2, those were carried forward. But in level 2, there were 2 new data elements suggested, substance, non-medication, and substance food. So the question before us is simply, does this task force recommend that moving these from level 2 to version 2 would make a Goldilocks difference?
Well, the substance can include 100,000 chemicals if you're talking about some of the code systems for them. And that's not Goldilocks. That's sort of the pop. I don't know which one is which extreme it's on. But
what was
recommended is
the. Add.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. I want to agree vociferously with Clem about the messiness of this field. Absolutely. And so the question that should we elevate this to, right now, will that messiness that will naturally ensue if we open this up, if someone says they're allergic to tree nuts, how does that relate to walnut? There's no vocabulary that can make that connection that I know of between tree nuts, say, and walnut. So that's just a minor example, but you're going to get a lot of data entered into the record, so that will be an outcome of this. How useful that data is, I'm not sure. It might be very useful, but I think we will add more mess, and whether that mess will be beneficial, it may very well be, but I think that's the question, the criteria to use to decide should we add foods and environmental allergens to this. But it is very messy.
Stephen, I'd like to comment as one of the people who put this forward. I think that the suggestion of having some constraints, as Clem indicates, could be a reasonable approach. But leaving it out because of messiness does not acknowledge the fact that it is a considerable worry to patients who might not understand all of the implications in care and who might actually understand more implications in care. So I think it'd be important for patients to be able to indicate these things. because when it isn't captured, then there can be very untoward events. And this is an opportunity to have people provide information about themselves they feel is important to themselves. And I think constraints, as Clem indicated, is a good start, but elimination because it's messy is irresponsible.
Can I ask our vendor reps to chime in? I'm pretty sure that all of the major EHRs endeavor to capture this data, probably in different formats. This was leveled as level two, suggesting that it's widely available, already being exchanged. The key question is simply whether or not this warrants inclusion in version two. What do the vendors feel about the challenge or lack thereof of including this?
Want me to start, Sasha?
Yeah, go ahead, Ron.
So from a standards perspective, I'm still just going back and forth between fire is easy. It's accommodated there, as Ricky already said. It's part of a version of US Core that's already being referenced. I think the discussion goes back to the codes that are available in SNOMED, because when we want to get the encoding, allergies have the opportunity to be encoded using SNOMED. That's what's being pointed to both by CCDA and FHIR. So I think it's more a matter of, is the vocabulary sufficiently granular or coarse for the purpose, than it is the can the systems handle it once those codes are there, because they're already able to collect allergies and intolerances at the moment. So I think it sits more in the vocabulary space.
From my experience, I guess I would think it would be reasonable to accommodate, but it's not something that Hans and I have had an opportunity to discuss with other vendors at EHRA. So we could certainly take that as a follow-up, but I don't know sort of broadly what the capabilities would be offhand.
Well, Sasha, why don't you hold that thought? Because I think there are going to be a number of these items that are similar, where we kind of like to run our ideas or recommendations by EHRA to see if there's a perspective that we're missing here, just having two major vendors represented.
Sure, we'd be happy to take some questions back to EHRA in our next meeting.
Awesome. Well, let's see how far we can get. Grace, I think you got us off to a good start, but let's keep moving and go as far as we can.
Okay, so we'll disregard the next line on the allergens, substance allergens, and move on to the next one. Leslie, can I defer to you to go over? I know we've already tackled the care team members, but this was the next three are you. Do you want to go through them quickly? So the care team members discussion that we had, we talked about changing a name, and I think that was consistent with this particular area, provider name, changing it to a care team member. That's one of the discussions that we had, and that also we were cautioned against, and I think we do have to come to some understanding about what are the consequences when we name something differently in one class than another. But our big issue here was that all of this information is necessary. It's almost if you get only one piece of information, what do you do without the rest? How do you contact a provider? How do you look them up? Where are they located? And so a piecemeal approach like this seems that we're on a path toward seems somewhat more constraining and more confusing than taking that entire class. And so we've talked about making sure that we have every care team member, at least in this beginning, to be able to have more information about the provider and all associated information, but also then to expand that role in future. For instance, under the patient and care partner information, which we'll get to in a minute. So Grace, did you want to add anything more on that?
No, I think that pretty much covers it.
Yeah, so I think we got enlightened by Clem's comment about stingy a while ago. So why are we being stingy on things that we use nonstop? And we've been passing this kind of information in HL7 for 40 years. So let's figure out how we can continue that and make this robust in this environment as well.
No
so
more
stinginess. We'd like to see this brought forward. Huh?
No more stinginess.
Exactly, Clem. So we would like to bring that forward also to V2. The same discussion on the next two around encounter information, the facility location, the name, this is all very basic information. Same argument, it's relevant, and in piecemeal approach seems more confusing and disruptive. As well as in the encounter information, we suggest aligning this with SNOMED, with encounter details, and making sure that we do not have a piecemeal approach, because those are constantly used in every bit of information that's shared. So it's the same of bringing these classes to be more robust and moving them into V2. And I would invite comments. And
Mark
has his hand up. Yep.
Yeah. Thanks. I just want to support and add that these elements, like the care team members and so forth, are especially important. They're critical for shared care planning, new delivery models, and also there's overlap with perhaps with the security and access functions, where you're identifying people that you may also want to know about for security and access. So another set of reasons why these should be included in V2. Thank you.
Andy? Mr. Truscott, do you have a comment?
Sorry, I was waxing lyrical while on mute. Apologies. I think I agree. This is well understood. It's well constrained. It's well documented. The only area I think we should touch upon would be relationship type, so that you actually have a way of capturing the relationship to the patient of the caregiver or care team member, etc., as an optional, probably. But that would seem sensible and logical to include. And then we can build upon a bunch of the HL7 V3 modelling that was actually done by the NHS some 17 years ago in this space.
So relationship type, just to be clear, V1 has care team members, draft V2 has provider name identifier as an addition. Level 2 includes provider telecom info, role, NPI, location, and DEA, and then comment is data steward. So the scope of this discussion has to do with the level 2 data elements that could potentially be elevated into version 2. So relationship type is not called out specifically. Provider role was actually submitted by none other than Dr. Al Taylor. So Al, do you want to comment on provider role and whether or not it is the same as relationship type?
Sure, and just the reason that we added it was because it was a requirement in certain other certification requirements. And so we had added some of those data elements, but that was part of the background. We provided a number of different provider elements into the OnDeck system, and then selected just the two of them. The provider role is, I mean, I think that we all understand what provider role means, and it's defined by the applicable standard for this is the provider taxonomy value set or the provider taxonomy list that's from NUCC. Looking at that value set, if you're not familiar with it, it's an interesting read actually, and it includes things that it could very easily be applicable to family members, because part of those roles, even though it's called provider role, usually refers to, you know, a medical provider or a healthcare provider, but there definitely includes parts of that list that include things like family member, caregiver, power of attorney, and other non, we'll call them non-medical provider roles. So I think that there's, along the lines of renaming provider role, I mean, provider name and provider identifier to care team name, care team member name, the role itself could be used to describe non-provider roles as well, even using the same standard of NUCC.
That's encouraging.
I think we could definitely use the same standard, but I do think that renaming it from provider role would remove the opportunity for confusion.
So that's a good thing. So you're saying that's a good thing to change the name, or it's a bad thing? I'm not quite sure.
It's a good thing. If it's called provider role, then it's explicitly stated that this is the role of a provider, as opposed to, you know, a care team is made up of people who are not just providers. And I did use the word just in a non-pejorative sense when I described providers.
Of course.
Dan has a comment, so does Hans.
My comment was along those same lines, just to be clear in your proposal, whether you are carrying forward this sort of broader idea that we started with, which was the things labeled as provider should really be sort of relabeled. What, I didn't know whether that was true or not.
It is. I think we were just simply asked to make sure as we do that, we deliberate for any downstream consequences. But the idea of the role being able to be used across both medical and non-medical personnel in the same standard is quite encouraging for our decision to change the name, or recommendation to change the name.
Okay, and then the second comment I had was just simply on, in our previous discussion about identifiers, I thought we had landed on a spot where, because it's sort of a more complex data type, multiple different kinds of identifiers could be shared, whether those are the DEA number, the NPI number, a locally created identifier, et cetera, and whether you were still thinking along those lines or whether this was intended to, in some other way, be sure we called out these specific types of identifiers.
Well, I think the one that's called out specifically is the DEA number and the NPI. So those are specific identifiers. I think in the broader provider identifier, or if we renamed it as care team member identifier, I think there's more flexibility.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, I don't see those as different. Meaning, one is the broader one is just a superset of all the possible ones.
That's fair. Hans?
A couple of questions. One is that, I got a 404 on the NUCC.org link. Is the NUCC indicated to be the role on the provider themselves, regardless what team they are in, or is it the role in the context of that particular team for that patient? That's question number
We had envisioned it to that particular patient in that particular event-specific role.
Right, so that's where the question then is that the NUCC, I couldn't look at it, is that meant to be, is it actually reflective of those roles as well, or quote-unquote just the independent role of the provider. So that's just curious about that. But we can take that off. The other question is that I tried that. That didn't, for some reason, work. But
worked for me for whatever reason.
Okay, we'll try again. The other one is provider location. Which location are we talking about here that would be of interest? That would help clarify, because there could be a number of different locations in play.
I think that whatever was in the level 2 definition of provider location, but I don't know at the time we had thought through all the potential locations as in telehealth. So that might warrant some further review or discussion, or addition of other standards that could be applicable when doing virtual locations of any kind as well as physical locations of any kind. Do you know, Hans, if there are any standards emerging for determining, for helping in those things like virtual care?
I think that's part of the question, that in what context it's being used to understand which location. So there's location information that can be captured, but are we capturing then the one in the right context? And when it's virtual, I think that's one of the areas of more confusion as to which one to use.
So, Hans, the physician provider was listed as a physical location. So that doesn't mean what services are provided at that physical, just what's the physical location of that provider. And if the services are being provided virtually, that's a different piece of data. But the provider location is talking about a physical location of the provider.
Thank you.
That still could be multiple, so it still would be helpful to understand which one.
Also, I think it's worth noting that these are all data elements attached to the care team member. This is not attached to the encounter. So presumably these would be, you know, static or, you know, long-standing attributes of the care team members. So a given provider who might have a location, you know, on Main Street might clearly provide encounters that are virtual or on Front Street or, you know, in the home, et cetera. So these are provider attributes, not encounter attributes. It is 5 minutes of the hour. We are going to quickly and awkwardly transition to public comments, and then we'll come back here if we have time.
Stephen, can you open the line for public comment?
Sorry, Al, you want to let something in?
I just wanted to let the call know that I'm going to have to drop prior to noon. So I'll stick here till the end of public comments, but I'm going to have to drop early.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you. If you would like to make a comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 if you would like to remove your line from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. Our first comment is from Tom Bronkin with Trinity Health. Please proceed.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes.
Okay, good. Good morning, everybody. My name is Tom Bronkin. I'm a physician informaticist who works for Trinity. My background is family medicine and emergency medicine, and currently I'm a member of the LOINC Document Ontology Subcommittee and the Sequoia Project Data Usability Workgroup. I'm here with Dee Dee Davis of the Sequoia Project. First of all, as a clinician, I need to tell you I'm very happy to see that clinical notes are included in the US CDI versions, and I think they're going to have a huge impact on interoperability and its usefulness. And I now understand that the 5 notes that you've chosen are exactly the right ones, I think. But at first, I didn't think so. And judging from some of the comments that were on version 1 of the US CDI, I wasn't the only one who thought that, I think, because there were others that commented that we need an outpatient encounter summary note. The Sequoia Project had a previous task force to the one I'm on that produced a report concerning those 5 clinical notes. And within the 5, there were 2 encounter summary notes. There was the inpatient encounter summary note, and that would be called the discharge summary, which makes sense. And they had the outpatient encounter summary note, which has been called the progress note. And that's where I see there's a problem that lies there. In the wild, as they say, providers, nurses, and clinicians refer to the progress note. When they talk about it, they're talking about notes that go on the inpatient chart daily while the patient is hospitalized. And I have to say, I've never heard of an outpatient office note or a DD note referred to as a progress note. Now, HL7 does define a progress note as either inpatient or outpatient, and LOINC has followed that convention. That's probably where this comes from. But again, it goes against the common understanding and usage of an outpatient summary note. So my comment for the task force is to consider changing the name of that outpatient encounter summary note to something that will be recognized as that. Otherwise, I'm afraid we're going to have tons of confusion. The wrong kind of notes are going to get sent. The right ones won't be sent, and we're going to spend the next few years trying to fix this. And I don't know if you take ask questions, but I'm willing to take any questions anybody has. Or if not, I thank you for the opportunity to address you.
Thank you, Tom. Clem, you have your hand up. Is that in reference to Dr. Bronken's comment or something else?
No, never mind.
Okay.
Yeah. Operator, do we have any other comments?
There are no more comments in the queue.
Okay, thank you.
I will thank Dee Dee Davis from the Sequoia Project for including in the public chat a link to the written comments, written version of what Tom just shared with us. All right, no more public comments. We have 0 minutes left, or less than 1 minute left, so I think we will call it a day. We will pick up our discussion on row 16 of the editable document, and thank you, Grace, for stepping forward. I think we're hoping to have both Grace and Michelle kind of walking us through some 1C recommendations at our next meeting, and the homework will be to review what they've put in the spreadsheet ahead of time so we can come with well thought out responses. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Stephen. Thank you all.
Bye.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.